Watts Whitehead here again to have another conversation with you about some of the stories that matter. Folks, it is indeed a pleasure and a delight to be back here with you at Today with Dr. K. I was away last week getting my youngest son settled in college. I am now an empty nester. My husband and I are at a whole different level. Everything hits differently when the baby goes off to college or goes off to the military or goes off to start their own life. Whatever it is that you have going on, it hits differently when the baby leaves home. So many of you reached out and just offered words of encouragement. So I wanted to thank you for just joining me on my journey. If you did not have an opportunity to participate in the journey to drop the baby off, just go right on to our Facebook page at Today with Dr. K. Go check it out on our Twitter page or go check it out on our IG page on Instagram. We are very active on social media and we invite you to come on the journey with us. Throughout the show, it might be a little difficult for you to call. No worries. If you have a comment, if you want to join the conversation, just go ahead and send me a tweet at KWhitehead. You can also send me an email at todaywithdrk@gmail.com. But find ways to engage with us. If you're in front of your computer, go ahead and pull it right up on Facebook Live. You can see the whole studio behind me as we walk through this show together. On Mondays, we have our political news roundtable, and there is a lot that is happening in the news, and we're going to try to get through as much of it as possible. At about 2:15 or so, I'll be joined by Dr. Sharon Wright Austin, our political scientist in residence, who joins me on the show to talk through the issues with me as we figure out where America is and where we are going next. It's interesting because a lot is happening in this country, and I want to invite you early on to give us a call, to call us at 410-319-8888. Put something on the table around all of the topics that have been happening in this country over the weekend and that have been happening around this planet over the weekend. Two things I want to point out as I give you the overview. And then I want to talk about Baltimore City because there's some things that are happening in our city that demand our attention. A couple of the big topics is that tomorrow is the final deadline for American troops, and that includes any American civilians, that includes anybody from Afghanistan who's been working with us. That's it. The deadline is tomorrow, and I know there's been a push to meet that deadline. Whichever side of the argument you fall, you know that the deadline is important either to show Biden and Biden supporters that he has the strength and the fortitude to take us through this, or to show the critics of Biden that it was a mistake to move so quickly. We know that the Taliban is quickly seizing control over every single thing, and they're dealing with this airport. That's what they're doing. This one single strip airport is where people have to get to get out of Afghanistan, and they're receiving all kind of notices about staying home. There's no way. We're not sure we can get you out. But tomorrow is the deadline for the final withdrawal from Afghanistan. So we want to keep our eye on that. Want to hear your thoughts about that. Today in Baltimore City and in a number of places around the country, schools reopen. This is it. We have the babies back in school, whether it is kindergarten through 12th grade or we're talking college. Everybody is back. I want us to just kind of wrestle with this for a moment because the way it stands now, we have allowed America, politicians, President Biden, health professionals, we have allowed them to convince us that COVID-19 is over. Let me tell you what I mean by that. Because last year, in the height of COVID-19, we were told that the best way to move was to lock down in place, to move within your own space until we got some type of handle on it. We were pushing toward a vaccine. We got a vaccine. Some of us are double vaxxed at this point. If you have Moderna or Pfizer, you're double vaxxed. If you're J&J, you only got the single dosage shot. Then they said that wasn't enough, that they were finding that, you know, there was an 8-month window where the vaccine wasn't effective after that period of time. So then they said, you know what, we need to do a booster. After about 8 months, you need to have a booster. Well, information came out this weekend that 8 months is not really accurate. That really what they're talking about is a 5-month window. So you're talking getting ready to go back and get the third COVID shot. So you'll be triple vaxxed is the way that we are moving and the direction that we're going in. Governor Hogan stated that he's already triple vaxxed because that is, for him and his health issues and challenges, he was first up in line to get this third dosage, a booster shot, right? We had healthcare professionals on the show informing us that it's a misnomer to call it a booster shot. It's not a booster shot. You're not boosting your immunity. It's a third dosage of the vaccine. So in fact, if you're in Israel right now, Israel has announced this weekend that they no longer consider double vaxxed people to be immune. They don't even call you vaccinated anymore if you've had two shots. They're only considering triple vaxxed people to be immune. I want us to think about the difficulties that we are dealing with, where the double vax is not, I don't even know what about Johnson & Johnson. I have no idea. Like, what's happening with that? Because you're only single vax, you got to get a second and a third dose. I don't know. I know for the double vax folks, Moderna, Pfizer, you need to get ready to get in line and get your third dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. You need to be triple vaxed. And right now, we know that Pfizer is the only one that has approved the triple vax, the third shot. Going back and getting one more. Now, what is very interesting with this is that this is coming alongside this big movement of the Delta variant. Now, we understand that we're now making our way through the Greek alphabet. We have the Alpha variant. We're now in Delta. There's also the PS1 Gamma variant. And now they're concerned about the Lambda variant that's making its way through, and that the Lambda variant is acting as an escape variant, and that's the one they may have to develop another vaccine for. So you need to be triple vaxxed to protect you against the current iteration of COVID-19, which is the Delta variant. They're not even really talking about the P1 Gamma variant. I'm not even sure if triple vax is enough. They're not really spending a lot of time on that, but they're saying, given what is happening with the Delta variant, which is highly transmissible, we know that the Delta variant is akin to somebody running a 4-minute mile while the Alpha variant runs a 6-minute mile, and you're back there huffing and puffing at a 13-minute mile. Like, you're not going to be able to catch up with how quickly these viruses are mutating. They're figuring us out faster than we can figure them out, and that means they have nothing else to do but find a host. That is the only goal of a virus, is to survive. And to survive, you need a host. If I have the vaccine, then you're not doing a good job of surviving my system. So you need to find an unvaccinated host so you can stay alive. And right now, the unvaccinated host are children and the unvaxxed who are dealing with the real impact of COVID-19. Story after story is coming out of the guy, a radio personality, called himself Mr. Anti-Vax. He died of COVID-19, did not believe in the vaccine. There have been stories of people this weekend who almost died of COVID-19, who were anti-COVID vaxxers, who've now found something different, who is now singing a different song. Donald Trump, who stood against COVID, who stood against the vaccine, is now telling his followers to go and get vaccinated. And they are so far gone, they're not even listening to him. So we as a society have been convinced that COVID is over. Because that's the only thing, that's the only way that we can explain what's happening. It's only in thinking that COVID-19 is over that you would, A, be willing to send your children back to school unvaccinated. B, be willing to go in the mall and deal with your shopping. C, head off to the movie theater to catch the big blockbusters. D, go back to work. E, eat in a restaurant. Like, you have to have some like belief that COVID is over, because they have said time and time again that COVID-19 does not stop just because there's a vaccine. It doesn't. Even though you're vaccinated, either single vaxxed, J&J, double vaxxed, Moderna and Pfizer, or triple vaxxed, which is Pfizer, you still can catch and give COVID-19, whether that's the Delta variant, Gamma, Lambda, or Alpha. In any case, you still can get it. The vaccine is going to keep you from the more severe symptoms from occurring, with the most severe, of course, being death, but even getting on a ventilator, having to go to the hospital, seeing what's happening with your lungs, all of that is a result, I think. And I'd love to hear from you, 410-319-8888. I don't think we're winning. I don't. I like to believe that we are. I don't think we're winning. I think COVID-19 is winning this battle. I do. Because every time we feel like we have it under control, something else happens. We thought we had the alpha variant under control. In fact, we weren't even calling it the alpha variant last year. Come with me. It started off, we called the coronavirus, and then we called it COVID-19. We weren't even calling alpha, beta, gamma. We weren't doing any of that. We were just talking about COVID-19, and we thought we had it figured out. And then it mutated. And then it mutated again. And then it mutated again. And now the mutation are the concern, the imperfect copies of the original virus is what's going to cripple us, if we really want to be honest about that. So let's talk about school openings. What do you think? Did you drop your child off this morning at school? What was that experience like? I've had real talk, people telling me that they had an anxiety attack, a panic attack as they were taking their children to school. I went over to City Neighbors High School today. They have a flower ceremony that they do at the start of the school year. So as the students come in, every student, every parent gets a flower. Getting a flower, welcoming them into the building, letting them know, hey, we see you, we recognize you, we respect you, we support you, we're here for you. So I went and joined that at City Neighbors and had an opportunity to interact with some of the students who, most of them were excited to be back. A few looked nervous and said they weren't really sure if it was the best decision, but it was a decision that their parents made. And so here they are. Mom said, I got to get up and go to school. This is what the ninth grader told me. So I had to get up and go to school because this is where I have to be. So we as adults are willing to sacrifice our children, to put them right on out on the line and taking a look at what that means. So we got Afghanistan. We got school openings. We're going to be joined by Dr. Sharon Wright Austin to talk through some of the other things that have happened this weekend, from Hurricane Ida, which hit, of course, on the 16th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. And what does it mean to deal with the impact of tropical storms and hurricanes and wildfires? And you're economically challenged. What does it mean to be able to pack up at a moment's notice and just go. Why didn't Tulane evacuate the students? They evacuated the football team. Students are complaining we were left on campus. Buildings were flooding. But the football team is away. Xavier University, why didn't they evacuate? So we want to talk about that. And we want to kind of work it through and open up the phone lines with you. I'm inviting now Dr. Sharon Wright Austin, who joins us on a regular basis on Mondays, to talk through the issues. Dr. Austin, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Well, I just want to jump right into it in terms of going through what's happening with the political situation around the country. So I want to start with Hurricane Ida. We know that it was bumped down. They thought Category 5. It became a Category 4. But the hurricane was so strong yesterday that for a brief period of time, just a couple of hours, Hurricane Ida was strong enough to reverse the course of the Mississippi River. So think of a 200-foot wall of water coming in like five apartment buildings or so, and that the hurricane was strong enough. But it's amazing that it was able to reverse the Mississippi. Well, it was flowing backwards is what was happening.
Right.
Can you talk for a bit about the impact of any kind of natural disasters on people who are economically challenged? Like who people from Hurricane Katrina who are like, you've had 16 years. Why aren't you able to leave? Who actually weren't able to pack up and just go?
Well, in some cases, it's not that simple. I mean, and that to me was a shocker when I heard about the Mississippi River, because I grew up in Memphis, which is right. They call Memphis the capital of Mississippi. And it's right on the Mississippi River. And so I'm like, that is one. I mean, any river is powerful, but that is one powerful river. So I was watching the news last night, and I saw that, and I was like, wow, that's a messed up storm. But I guess to answer your question, it's not that easy for some people to pack up and leave. I mean, because you need resources and money to leave. So let's say if you are someone who's living in a poor neighborhood, especially if you've got kids, and you want to pack your kids and you want to leave. Now, there are resources. There are different shelters, I'm sure. They were a lot more prepared, it seems, this time than Hurricane Katrina and previous hurricanes in that area. But, I mean, it's not easy to leave because you have to, first of all, find a hotel that has some vacancies. And as someone who lives in Florida, who has lived through these types of hurricanes and evacuations and things, I know what it's like. You have to leave really, really early. I mean, days, if possible, as early as you can. So you have to leave several days before the storm is to hit. And so what if you have the type of job where you can't take off from work? Because we can't assume that people can just say, okay, well, a hurricane's coming and they're telling us to leave and I can't come to work. I need to leave now because if not, I won't be able to get out of the city. Well, what if you have a boss that doesn't allow you to do that? So that's the first thing. And even if you can leave, you then have to find a hotel that has some vacancies, which is almost impossible. Whenever there's any hint of a hurricane coming, the hotels immediately are booked. And so that's even difficult. But even if you can't find a hotel room, you first of all need money. And there have been incidents of price gouging in which people who have owned hotels, especially the smaller ones, have raised the prices because they know that they can really make a big profit because they know the hotel is going to be booked by people who are fleeing the hurricane site. So you need money in order to be able to evacuate. Now, luckily, cities usually have things in place to help people get out, but they usually don't provide the transportation. They do provide shelters and things. But if you're in a situation like what they were facing in Louisiana, even if you're in a shelter, you're no safer there than you are anywhere else because as I was watching the news and I saw them blow the roof off of a building, I think it was like an emergency services place, like a hospital, and they blew the roof off. So even if you were in a shelter, like the people in the Superdome during Hurricane Katrina, the roof can be blown off, so you're not safe. So it's not that easy to evacuate. You don't have the money. Sometimes you don't have the transportation. If you're someone who largely depends on public transportation is suspended during these time periods. So it's not that easy.
I think what's interesting, and I put this out on my Twitter, I said, you know, as you begin to critique people, why didn't they just leave? I said, stop for a second and think about if you had to evacuate immediately, even if you say a couple of days, could you come up with the money you needed to evacuate your entire family? Do you have a car at your disposal to be able to jump in there? Do you have resources, places to stay? If hotels are booked or there's price gouging, do you know people that you can go stay with? What if you have pets? Who's taking your dogs or cats or whatever pets you might have? What if you have people in your family who are physically unable to travel? What about if you need medicine? Like, there's just all these other issues that are laid on the table. Well, I put it on the table because I was talking about Hurricane Ida. People begin to respond, Dr. Austin, and they added in wildfires. Well, what about if there's a wildfire coming? Someone else added in, what about a situation with domestic violence? Somebody said Afghanistan. Like, it was able to apply across the board about the ability that there's a certain amount of privilege that comes with being able to pack up and leave at even a couple of days' notice.
Right, exactly. And especially, like, I'm glad you mentioned the part about people who have family members with disabilities, because my son has a disability. My teenage son is severely autistic, and it wouldn't be a problem. My son likes to travel, so it wouldn't be a problem if we ever had to evacuate. But he would have a hard time being stuck in traffic on an expressway for 2 hours. And that typically happens whenever you have to evacuate. Everyone's trying to leave, and the expressways are so crowded that you can sit on an expressway for an hour or two and maybe only travel 5 or 10 miles. So if you have someone who has a disability and you just can't pull over and stop, I mean, that's another thing that you have to think about that makes it almost impossible. So it sounds easy. It sounds like, oh, why don't they just leave? And if they didn't leave, they must have wanted to have gotten stranded. But it's not that simple.
Well, this is the thing I don't understand. As we're looking at this, Hurricane Katrina happened 16 years ago. And I remember right after that, there was a promise, a commitment of millions of dollars to help support the levees, right? You know, that New Orleans sits in the bowl for people, just kind of as a reminder that that was a problem with Hurricane Katrina. When the levees broke, if you sit in the bowl fills up with water.
Mm-hmm.
That this notion that after 16 years, there are still people who are living in some of the most economically challenged communities, it's as if life did not move forward in some of these communities. And I find that to be very concerning.
Right. Absolutely. And then another thing I find concerning is someone who's visited New Orleans over the years, a lot of the areas that were destroyed by Hurricane Katrina never fully recovered, because the emphasis was on recovering the tourist areas, you know, and some of them weren't even all that affected, like the French Quarter, Bourbon Street, and all the different places that tourists go to. Those places were rebuilt. The football stadium, of course, was rebuilt. But a lot of those neighborhoods, especially the poorer neighborhoods, were never actually renovated. And some of them still look almost as bad as they did right after Hurricane Katrina. And so that is another thing that usually happens whenever there's any type of natural disaster. The priority is on only improving certain areas of the city, the areas where the middle-class people live, and also the areas where the tourists are most likely to visit. But the areas where the poor people live are the last to be addressed. And so that's what happened in New Orleans, and that's what happens in most cities whenever there's any type of natural disaster.
Well, then let's talk about what's happening when it comes to school openings.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that, I'm on break. Let me just take a quick break here.
Okay.
When we come back, I want to talk about school openings. I want to talk about the horse deworming medicine that people are taking. I want to talk about Afghanistan, since the deadline is tomorrow. And just this idea that maybe we're being convinced that something has ended without it actually being over. So we're going to hold it here, Dr. Austin. When we come back, folks, we're going to address all of that, and we open up the phone lines for you at 410-319-8888. Stay with us. I'm Dr. K.Y.'s Whitehead. I'm on with Dr. Austin. We usually talk on Mondays for kind of a weekend political roundup. We just spent some time talking about Hurricane Ida. Dr. Austin, how are you? Thank you again for staying with us.
I'm doing great.
So let's talk about Afghanistan. I want to keep making it very broad, then we'll narrow it into talking about schools. Tomorrow is the deadline. That is it. And I know that President Biden, on one hand, there are people who are supporting him, just as always, but he's also getting a lot of criticism right now because it doesn't seem like we're going to be able to get everyone. Everyone includes American civilians as well as people from Afghanistan who've been working alongside us for the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think is going to happen tomorrow? What does it look like in terms of pulling everybody out, meeting this hard deadline?
Well, it's hard to say because, you know, there is a hard deadline and it's being said that it should be extended. But the Taliban is given a commitment to allow American citizens and also legal permanent residents and some Afghan allies to be able to leave to come to the United States. The problem with that is you can't believe a word that they say because we know that these are people who are ruthless and not trustworthy. So it's hard to say what will happen after tomorrow. They're saying they'll let people leave, but that's probably less than 24 hours from now. And I doubt that everyone who's there who wants to leave will be able to. So the question I think that the Biden administration is thinking about now is what are they going to do if and when that deadline comes and goes and people are still stranded there trying to get out? How are they going to keep these Americans safe?
Yeah, I'm not sure because if the deal is, and this is the deal that was set last year that was originally signed by Donald Trump and Pompeo, if we hold to that, for us to be a country that keeps its word, I know that's very important to America. We keep our word. It means we are definitely out of there tomorrow. And whatever happens, happens. I don't think the Taliban has ever been concerned about being seen as the angel of the planet.
No, they're not.
When Joe Biden says, no, this is not a good thing, you know, people are going to be upset, I don't think they care what mm-hmm. people think. I mean, we know that the way that women and girls have been treated in that country, the way human rights have been mm-hmm. taken away from people. So I don't think the Taliban cares what we think about them.
Right.
So
they,
I'm not
they don't.
Sure. Yeah, I don't think, yeah. And once American soldiers leave, do you think, Dr. Austin, that the sentiment around what's happening in Afghanistan change with that suicide bomber and the loss of 13 American soldiers? We're definitely praying for their families as well as countless Afghanistan residents.
Right, because I think that's a reminder of what's going to continue to happen with the suicide bombers. These are the types of things that have been going on for many years. Another problem with this August 31st deadline is that the evacuations have taken place at a much slower pace. Ever since President Biden announced that they were going to withdraw from Afghanistan and set this deadline, it was expected that people would get out much sooner, but it's been harder for people to get out because, you know, the last time I was on your show, we talked about the footage of people at the airport trying to get out. And so it's been really, really difficult for people even to evacuate. And so now that there's this hard deadline, we pretty much know that people are not going to be able to get out. And then with the recent terrorist attack that you just mentioned, in which 13 U.S. service members died, that's also going to be something, unfortunately, that we're going to see a lot of. So the question for the Biden administration is, how are you going to make sure that Americans are safe? But even a larger question for human rights activists all around the world is, how are you going to, as America, as a world power that's supposed to help and defend other countries, how are you, even after we get the Americans out, are you going to ensure that the people of Afghanistan are safe? What responsibility do we have to ensure that? And if we do have a responsibility, how are we going to do so?
But Dr. Austin, I've been wrestling with this all weekend, and I think I've probably been wrestling with this ever since 9/11. I think 9/11, to me, spoke volumes. I remember 9/11 very vividly. How do you export democracy? Like, how do you do that? How do you say, like, our goal is to bring democracy to the rest of the world, that we are not practicing a policy of isolationism, but that we are, I don't know, the peacekeepers, the ones to intervene, the big brother, if you want to say it in such, you know, a negative way, for the entire planet. And we are going to set up and export our version of democracy. It doesn't seem to be able to hold, though, Dr. Austin.
Right, and I think that's something that we've learned for many, many, many years, that it doesn't hold. I think that in America, our intentions are good to try to bring democracy to other countries, but even some members of other countries, some of the residents of those countries don't like the fact that Americans interfere. Because I think 9/11 showed us, if you remember, I remember, of course, the day that it happened and seeing the footage of people in other countries celebrating when they saw what had happened here, because that showed the perception that many people had of Americans, and many people here couldn't understand why anybody would be happy to see that America was the target of this terrorist attack. But even though I think our intentions are good, nevertheless, it's not always well received, because there are some people in other countries who kind of see Americans even as just being bullies, as people who are trying to come in and force our views off on them. But I think other people in those countries appreciate the fact that we do have a democracy here, in which there are certain things that we can say and do in this country that they can only think about doing in their countries, and they appreciate that. So I guess in some ways, America is seen in both a positive and a negative light.
And I wonder what that means for us, because now this is where I want to break this down, Dr. Austin. Okay, so let me tell you what I'm getting to. We are exporting democracy, or so we say we are anyway. And I'm thinking that language, other than I think FDR, after FDR coming forward, presidents across the board have used that language about exporting democracy, about the role and responsibility of America to the planet. I mean, us bending our privilege, so to speak, that we have to be the first ones on the ground because of how privileged we are and everything that we have to offer. Okay, how do we export democracy while there are many people who live in this country who argue that they're not even experiencing democracy?
Right, right. I mean, go ahead.
I'm just saying, we're exporting something that we don't necessarily live out here in this country.
Right, and that's always been the case with America. And I think back to even Vietnam and other wars as well, and even if you go all the way back to World War I and World War II, when African-American soldiers would come back to this country after having served and fought wars for this country, fighting for democracy abroad, and yet would come back to this country and have to deal with blacks only, whites only, public accommodations, segregation. And I think about even when Muhammad Ali refused to be drafted because he was saying, why should I go and fight a war in another country when I come back to my country and I'm being treated badly? So that's something that Americans have always debated. We are trying to bring about democracy and fairness in other countries. But yet, in some cases, I mean, recent events have shown us, or even not just recent events, but historically, we've seen that in this country, there's a lot of inequity. A lot of it is based on race, but on other things as well. So I guess it kind of makes us look like hypocrites, in the sense that we're fighting to bring democracy to other countries that we don't even have in some communities in our own country.
And we have never experienced, and maybe, at least in the short term, will never experience. I mean, when we start talking about fundamentally changing the landscape of this country, Dr. Austin, if we really want to talk about what exporting and importing this notion of democracy would mean, we're talking about dismantling the systems of racism and white supremacy in this country. And people don't want to have that conversation, not in a way that actually seeks to change the landscape.
Right. They certainly don't, and that's something that we're fully aware of, that I think even after the murder of George Floyd, we saw protests and people finally were talking about race and racial justice as if they were shocked that this type of thing could have happened. But even now, I guess the year that has passed since then, we're no longer even seeing those conversations. It's like that was something that happened, and then it's like we just moved on to another issue. But we never really want to talk about race. And even beyond that, we never really want to talk about black-white issues. Even when we talk about race and we talk about the racism that African-Americans have dealt with, you know, other groups of people come in and say, our group has been treated badly, too. And that's true. But the black-white question is something that we have never really wanted to address in this country.
Which is a reminder of two very important milestones. I mean, I'm saying milestones that we reached this weekend. So this weekend, of course, on August 28th, we had to stop and we had to think about two things that happened on that date. One, of course, was in 1955 with the murder, the lynching of Emmett Till. And the fact that Emmett Till's killers were never found guilty of the crime. right? So they were set free, as we knew they would be. You're talking about well, down in what, Money, Mississippi. We knew that they were going to be able to walk away. This is your hometown area here, Dr. Austin.
Right.
That in no way, back in 1955, were two white men going to go to jail for killing a little black boy who was accused of whistling at a white woman or calling her baby. Well, they, again, sold their story later to say we did it. So they were very clear and they were bragging about it. But what's interesting is only recently in the last 10 years, it came out that the white woman that accused them, that started off accusing Emmett Till, setting this whole thing in motion, that she lied.
Right.
But they're not bringing any charges against her. So there is no justice in that situation. At the same time, that was the exact same date in 1963 of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. So 250,000 or so folks marched in Washington with everybody on the program from Dr. King to John Lewis talking about freedom, justice, fighting for economic justice across the land, neither of which have been achieved. I don't think, Dr. Austin, there's been no justice when it comes to white men killing black children and black men and black women. Not across the board. We know we have different situations. George Floyd's killer was held accountable. Like, I think we can count them out.
Right.
But so many have walked away. Nor have we received the level of job entry that comes with economic, social, and political freedom in this country. That has not happened. So how do we move forward?
Well, I mean, and it's the same protests that keep repeating themselves over and over. I mean, with Emmett Till, that was the beginning of the modern civil rights movement. And speaking of Emmett Till and the white woman whose name was Carolyn Bryant, who accused him, they said that the trial took place for approximately an hour. And the only reason it took that long, not the trial, but the verdict, the jury's deliberations took place for about an hour. And the only reason it took place for that long is because they took a break to get a Coke.
Yeah.
And so they pretty much knew that this was just a farce. And she showed no remorse. And then even one of the men, Roy Bryant, who later, as you said, confessed to the killing, operated a grocery store in a predominantly black neighborhood for many, many years. So, you know, she was never brought to justice. And the two men now are deceased. But, you know, and then in the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, you could argue that we have made progress in some sense since then, because you do have African Americans in positions where they can now hold jobs in 1963 that weren't really available to us. But you still have a lot of inequities, especially when it comes to pay, when it comes to promotions, even when it comes to hiring. There still is a lot of discrimination. But the thing about today's discrimination is that it's much harder to prove, because in order to prove any type of discrimination claim, you have to prove that the person or persons that discriminated against you intended to do so. And that's almost impossible to do so. In 1963, people would just come right out and say that, I don't want to hire black people, I don't want to do this or that. But in today's society, people would deny being racist, and so it's even harder to prove. So, again, we're fighting the same battles, and there still is a lot of racism and discrimination. It's just in today's society, it's much harder to prove because it's so subtle and people try to hide it.
But then it's interesting, because in some cases it's subtle, but in some cases it's very overt. Like some of the things that we hear in the street, some of the conversations that politicians are even having, that they're cloaking behind this idea of critical race theory. We don't want white children to feel ashamed or embarrassed or feel like they're responsible. I mean, but that is nothing but coded language for a teaching that's based upon one racial group being seen as being inferior, while the other is positioned as being superior. I was doing a training this morning, some DEI training, and talking about how, you know, for slavery to have lasted so long, there was a teaching that was going on that led white children early on to believe that they were superior. They had to. You had to have this belief, because if the mammy who breastfed you, you grew up believing that you had complete control over her. You were better than her, even though she helped to raise you. That's a teaching around superiority, around having people around whose main goal is to serve you. But for that superiority line, that threat line to be taught, there had to be a separate line that taught enslaved black folks that they were inferior. Both things happen at the same time.
Right.
And they let us see where we are now.
Yeah, that's where we are now, especially, you know, again, everything comes out, boils down to Florida, because that's the debate we're having here with our governor banning the teaching of critical race theory. And even before our semester began, we were asked questions. Even some media outlets were contacting certain professors, asking them, how are you going to make sure that you include conservative perspectives in your classes, because your classes are too liberal? And I think both of us know, from being on college campuses for many years, many of our students are far from liberal. They're not liberal at all. But, I mean, you know, here there's an assault on critical race theory, and we pretty much have been told that we're not to teach it, and that has major implications for people like me and other people who teach courses that deal with race and African Americans and want to teach critical race theory. But we're having difficulty because people are in denial about what it is. If you know what critical race theory is, you wouldn't object to it, because it pretty much is just saying that when you teach, you're supposed to teach the truth about American issues, and especially with my field, American politics. And you can't talk about American politics without talking about racism, because even when you go back to the drafting and signing of the U.S. Constitution and throughout history, race has always been an issue. And a lot of that is because of the complexities that have resulted from the legacy of slavery. So, I mean, you now have a situation where, as educators, we're being told, don't talk about critical race theory because you're making people feel bad and this and that. But you really are just telling the truth about our society. And if that makes people feel bad, then that's too bad. But that's just the truth. That's just the way it is.
Well, then on a lighter note, with some other things that have been happening in the news, two things in particular that I am now questioning the overall ability of us to be able to be self-functioning. I'm really have some questions about that. And I don't mean we as a Black community. I'm saying as a nation as a whole. I'm not sure if we even have the capacity anymore for the type of work we need to do to fundamentally change this culture and this system. Two things I want to put out. One is the milk crate challenge. As I watch this play out, it's at the point now that even though it started off as all fun and games, you know, TikTok has now banned any milk crate challenge videos to be aired on their platform. That it got so bad. And you had doctors coming out. You had the FDA coming out. Like, you had to have people actually making statements begging people, do not do this. And it didn't stop until TikTok, after pressure, has now banned all milk crate challenge videos because people wouldn't stop. I think that says a lot. I don't know if it's because we've been in a pandemic. Maybe we needed something else to do. But I know that when doctors and nurses came out and said, look, we don't have room in the hospital for this. We just don't. We need you to stop. So you add that to people taking ivermectin, this horse deworming medicine. And I went out. Now, I seem to have a lot of free time, Dr. I went, I read all the articles about it. They've been talking about this horse deworming medicine, ivermectin, ever since they were talking about hydrochloroquine.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this has been going on for a year now. If you go back to last summer, you can see on these particular websites, they've been talking about this. They have been taking, they've been talking about the best ways to take it, to put it with jelly. We know it's gross. I mean, really having intense conversations of how you can trick your veterinarian into giving you, and also how you can do the math for how much it would be for a horse versus how much you weigh. So what does that say, Dr. Austin, about just having the ability right now in this country to just even be able to function as a society? Because both of these things are so extreme and really have me baffled here.
Right. I mean, I think that you just have to use common sense, because even when you think about what you mentioned with the milk crate challenge, you always see things on either through the internet or even maybe MTV has had some television shows where people have done these dangerous stunts. And I think that they honestly don't think that they can get hurt. But common sense ought to tell you that, you know, that you can, that just because you see someone doing something, a TikTok video or doing something online, nevertheless, I mean, you need to use common sense because you could kill yourself. But I was really just shocked when I saw the one about the ivermectin?
Using
that to thinking that that can help you treat COVID. And some of the same people who are willing to take something that you give to horses would not want to get the COVID vaccine and wouldn't want to get the shot. So the U.S. FDA recently had to put something on Twitter. The Food and Drug Administration had to put something on Twitter and just let people know that you should not use this medicine to try to treat or prevent COVID. Because I don't know where you heard this rumor from, but it's for horses. It's for animals. It's not for people. And so they had to let people know. And I think the reason they put it on Twitter is because so many young people are more likely to use Twitter than, I mean, you know, my generation and yours probably watch something on television. But they watch and get their news from Twitter, from social media, and from the internet. And so this is something that really could not only make you sick, but it could even kill you. So in other words, the FDA is telling people, use common sense and don't just listen to these rumors, but follow the guidelines, wear your mask, use the social distance, get the vaccine, and do those things. And don't listen to these rumors that something that can treat worms and animals is something that could be used to help you so that you won't get COVID, because it just doesn't make any sense.
I'm not sure if common sense is in charge anymore. I say that because the FDA also had to put out a ruling just under President Donald Trump. Remember, don't drink bleach?
Oh, yeah, I remember.
They actually had to put out a statement because not only were people drinking bleach, there were case people end up in the hospital. Remember the elderly couple? Where her husband drank it. Because they're like, oh, we have exactly what the president's talking about. And that point, I think it was like fish cleaner. Like, just think about what we're dealing with here in terms of following what's going on the internet. Because that leads to my next question for you. I think that there's something happening with technology here, and it's out of control. Is it ever going to be a point where we're able as a society to back up off of our use of technology? Or has it gone on for so long and it's so entrenched that we're too far gone now?
Well, I think technology is good because it really can be useful as far as educating people. And, you know, there are a lot of ways that we benefited from the internet and from social media. Practically everyone has a cell phone. And I think all of those things are really important as far as educating people. But I think that sometimes you do have these rumors that surface, and that it's like on the internet, they try to make them so believable that people actually start to believe them. And especially when President Trump was in office, and once he even was saying something to support this view that if you took bleach or some type of, like, I guess, cleanser or something, that it could help you and not get COVID. At least now we have political leaders in place who wouldn't say, you know, reckless things like that. And even if they did, they would quickly get called on it. So, I think that the media, and as far as the electronic media, that it's been really useful and helpful over the years. But I think that some people can kind of use it in a really negative way to sort of mislead people.
It's interesting because I'm a big social media person. But I think about how it has shifted everything. That the ways in which we engage with one another, there may have been, I think the window for backing up off of social media, I think the window has closed. And this is what I mean. I think prior to COVID-19, there was a chance that we weren't going to be as addicted to social media and technology that the research showed, that we were really driving up the addiction numbers. COVID-19... out of everything it did, it tied us, it tethered us to technology in ways that we've never seen before. It's actually worse, I would say, Dr. Mm-hmm. Austin, because now instead of going to the office, right, as people complain, the office is at my house, and that there are no more boundaries between us and work anymore.
Right.
You always have your phone, so you're always able to engage. I am just shocked at the number of late night emails I get. I'm shocked at the number of late night meetings I have. I'm like, wow, we don't turn off anymore.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Especially those of us who are in academia, but I think just people in general. But in the summer, it used to be for professors that we would mostly use the summers for our research because you didn't really have time to do research during the school year. But now, in the summer, ever since we've had the COVID, and we were mostly working at home, In the summers, we now have meetings, and that was something that never used to happen. So like you said, it's like you never really get to turn it off. You know, and sometimes even I just put things away on the weekend. I just turn off the TV because if you don't, you just will get so exhausted.
Well, then my last conversation topic I want to throw out on the table, here in Baltimore City today, young people went back to school. And we are now trying to go back to normal, whatever that means. What is your sense around the country of what's happening with these school openings? I see my schools are opening and closing very quickly right now.
Right, right. Yeah, especially here in Florida, the schools opened really last year, but they gave them the virtual option. This year there wasn't really a virtual option, but there was a major lawsuit that was just handed down last week when a federal judge, a group of citizens, a parent had sued our governor, and they ended up winning because our governor had issued a ban on mask mandates. And so a federal judge struck that down and said to school districts in the state of Florida that you can issue a mask mandate requiring that students and that staff and faculty wear masks. And so that was a major victory. But nevertheless, even though the schools even reopened last year and even more so this year, a number of schools have had to close down and shift to virtual because the COVID rates have gotten so high in so many schools and it's affecting so many young children that I think that's something that's happening around the country, that as people are now sending their kids back to school, there's a new sense of fear because now COVID is now affecting young children, whereas before we thought that children pretty much were immune from it. Now we're seeing children not only getting it, but in a few cases, children have even died from it, and that's something that's really frightening.
Well, we're going to continue to watch this. We'll continue this in our next conversation. Dr. Sharon Wright Austin from the University of Florida, thank you so much for joining us as our political scientist in residence.
Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. So, folks, stay with us. When we come back, yesterday on CBS Sunday Morning, they were talking about a violent city, and yes, they were talking about Baltimore. I have clips from that, and I want to open up the phone lines to you when we return.